Yes, I guess I'd just like to kind of conclude the day, not necessarily with a kind of formal presentation as such, but just a series of kind of thematic digressions, some of the themes that kind of come off Joey's show, specifically in relation to the public image of pharmaceutical research and the commercialisation of genetic modification and the tendency toward conspiracy theory that some of her recent work suggests, which is a specific area that I'm quite interested in myself. I think about this against the background of the inadequacy of the term Anthropocene and the necessary differentiation of that concept, which I believe Joey's work goes some ways towards providing tools for thinking or adding complexity, not only by way of the suggestions of species precarity drawn against anti-anthropocentric leanings, but by its evocation of species porosity, where codependency, vulnerability and cross-contamination are acknowledged as productive contingencies. Whenever I see contemporary art exhibitions in sort of pastoral contexts like Weising, I always look for the particular qualities of the rural that impress upon the work or sort of parenthetically buffer it. The other week I kind of cycled out to Weising from Cambridge, and I was looking for road signs to Camborne and Bourne to find my way there, and every so often the name Huntingdon kept coming up. And a few years ago I did a cycle ride from Nottingham to Amsterdam, and it was at the height of the Huntingdon Life Sciences animal rights controversy. This is Huntingdon Life Sciences here. It's kind of fully visible from the road. You can sort of cycle past it, and it's marked. Trying to kind of find a mediary point between reading and talking. So Huntingdon Life Sciences specialises in preclinical and non-clinical biological safety evaluation. It offers research services into biopharmaceutical testing and crop protection with a focus on world-leading in vivo resources. I guess that means experimentation on living organisms. In 1997, the company became the target of a high-profile crusade by animal rights activists after its maltreatment of specimens was exposed in a film made by the video journalist Zoe Broughton. Filmed whilst working undercover as a lab technician, Broughton's discreet camera work documented the barbaric treatment of dogs in captivity. While the expose led police officers straight to the company's door the day following its broadcast on national television, it also led to a new form of terroristic animal rights activism by a group known as Stop Huntingdon Animal Cruelty, or SHAC, whose strategies of intimidation included bomb threats and personalised campaigns of defamation against the company employees. And their protest measures were kind of quite crude and tasteless. So this is a kind of assemblage outside the lab itself on the perimeter fence. And there are also break-ins and multiple instances of like graffiti against private property and the labs themselves. What was particularly unprecedented about SHAC's approach to industrial sabotage was the pursuit it made of arterial lines of influence, whereby a shareholder, courier, or even a stationery supplier like Staples was just as likely to come under attack as a chemist or an analyst. Broughton's film is interesting to me in a slightly different sense, because it recharacterised the laboratory as something of a pharmaceutical black site, prompting the revelation that the bucolic English countryside could be harbouring clandestine research facilities, and that the labouring animal of a romantic agrarian past had been consigned to new forms of techno-pharmaceutical labour that promised a somehow darker fate. I borrow the term black site from the practice of artist Trevor Paglen. It's not his term per se, but it's one that he's kind of used regularly and has kind of characterised in his own way. His exercises in long-distance photographic reconnaissance and satellite monitoring have attempted to map the dark geography of American imperialism in an age of data sovereignty and the covert testing of unmanned weaponry, factors that have to a large extent shaped the ambition of US foreign policy for the past 15 years. Black sites are geographical locations that, through complex procedures of infrastructural and judicial maintenance, resist cartographic legibility. They are physically present, yet work to evade recognition. A company like Huntingdon Life Sciences, then, faces the dual challenge of presenting itself publicly to potential clients in the biotech sector, more strategically obfuscating the activities of its laboratories for the sake of trade privacy, which I guess is kind of fair enough. But it's brought in a self-account in an insightful retrospective piece for The Guardian in 2006. Developments in animal rights legislation since the 1990s may have created a culture of openness within the scientific community, but calls upon the Freedom of Information Act to force Huntington to disclose the particularities of their approach to animal testing have been met with counterclaims of commercial confidentiality. And in one instance in the United States, a gagging order placed against a member of the animal welfare group PETA, who allegedly documented instances of unanaesthetised vivisection in a facility located in New Jersey. What struck me in light of Joey's show in particular, with its positioning of Ophiux as a speculative pharmaceutical brand, whose commercial identity became the focus of the film we saw earlier, and an installation which is kind of part operating theatre, part sales podium, was the polarity of visibility and occlusion occurring between Weissing's exhibition space and Huntingdon, which had to actively manage its identity despite its public shaming, which drove their share prices and their ethical reputation into total disrepute. Ophiux is a coining, a kind of pseudo-Latin evocation of the constellation Ophiuchus, whose name derives from the Greek term serpent-bearer. When a corporation looks to the stars for its title, the intended implication isn't simply an evocation of celestial majesty, but an attempt to channel something of the expansive and encompassing nature of cosmological immensity into our understanding of the company's productive and commercial reach. Interestingly, Huntingdon Life Sciences itself had been subject to an international merger last year in which its brand image had been manipulated by a similarly false Latinization to Ophiux, whereby the term Envigo had been coined to identify a composite of companies operating under the same weird aspirational amalgamation of the words enhance and vigo, which is an abbreviation of vigorous, including the Latin root vita. So Envigo stands to enhance life. This was a kind of brand washing, I think, to try and put some distance between the reputation of Huntingdon and its kind of move into a new sort of conglomeration with a few different companies. They made this kind of particularly grating infomercial, which you can just find on YouTube, and I'll play a few moments of it because it has some of the company employees talking about what the name means to them, the significance of it, and how it kind of potentially changes the direction of their research. This might be quite loud.
I think Envigo is modern and it's crisp.
Sounds dynamic. Really great name. I think it's short, snappy.
It's very easy to say in the different languages in Europe. So, yes, I like Envigo.
So you're like, wow. It, just from one word, it tells us who we are and what we do. It's different. It's unique.
It gives us something fresh to work towards. Getting in
for enhanced and legal from my perspective, enhancing lives. And the brand story really, really fit well together.
The more products we can bring out onto the market, the more lives we save. My grandma died of cancer, and I try and give something back.
It's helping people have a longer, better life, and I believe that we really do make a difference.
My passion is fishing. I come to fishing, I breathe fishing, so the importance of an environment that allows us to do that is very important.
I don't know, I've just always been around animals, and I think that's just been a passion.
I'm a veterinary animal, so of course, my main goal is to work with animals and to guarantee their welfare. It's important also to translate all these applications on animals on human disease.
You have to show the customer that they are the focus and they have value.
It gets a bit grating after a while. At the point in the mid-90s, when the Huntington fiasco was blowing up, my juvenile understanding of genetic research, indeed the potentialities of scientific research in general, had been largely determined by the popular fiction of one man, Michael Crichton, who probably did more to skew and embellish the popular conception of transgenic modification and gleeful hodgepodge biohacking than any other author I can think of. Crichton was a medically trained doctor turned science fiction author, who we now associate with the kinds of tech fantasy pulp thrillers you find for discount prices at W.H. Smith's. But I'd like to make a case for kind of reinstating him as an essential visionary. I think art writers have a tendency to kind of gravitate towards big ideas authors like Ursula K. Le Guin, William Gibson, Philip K. Dick and Octavia Butler. And Michael Crichton is this kind of like crappy, crass pulp author that seems to get left behind. But the thing that I find really kind of great about his work is that he takes sort of topical scientific development and then smashes them immediately into the absolute banality of commercialization. So the moment that the genetic kind of resuscitation of dinosaurs becomes available, that's in some ways like commercialized and turned into a visitor experience. In fact, it's delivered directly from his labs into kind of scenario visitor experience. As a kind of momentary aside, and it's totally kind of befitting Crichton's work in terms of Westworld and Jurassic Park, Disney have just begun to implement biometric scanning at their resorts in order to identify legitimate ticket holders. As though the ticket price weren't enough of a form of social partitioning, but the body of the visitor is now forced to perform as a kind of currency of legitimation in the admission of those at the park deemed desirable. Crichton's interest in biotechnology was in some sense a response to the fateful meeting of venture capitalist Robert Swanson and the biochemist Herbert Boyer in 1976, an encounter which brought about the founding of GeneEngineck, a gene splicing company that quickly became the largest and most successful of the genetic engineering startups. That's incredibly more pixelated than it is on my screen, I apologise. For Crichton, this affected the reconfiguration of science's tolerance of industry, with purist hierarchies of institutional affiliation being broken down by a highly competitive market of equity positions and consultancies. It led him to imagine the medicine conglomerate InGen, his billionaire founder, John Hammond, would headhunt talent capable of resurrecting dinosaurs to be exhibited at his island resort. Jurassic Park presented a simplified image of genetic code, and along with it, the proposition that prehistoric DNA could be recuperated from the fossilized remains of mosquitoes. As the paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould notes in his fantastic essay, Dinomania, this idea had been kicking around paleontological labs for some time, and had yielded some results in the form of insect DNA recovery, notably that of a fossil weevil potentially 135 million years old, which I think is Cretaceous and not Jurassic. But notably, that revelation was kind of released, the information about that revelation was released at the same time that the film was kind of billed to come out. So it was the scientific industry playing on this kind of Hollywood narrative and using that to repel its own research. For Gould, Crichton's science was lacking, and he addresses those hopeful of the dinosaurs' return with the somber admonishment that DNA is not a geologically stable compound. We may recover a few fragments here and there, but the transgenic manipulations of Jurassic Park scientists are frankly absurd. An animal is an integrated entity, he writes, not the summation of its genes. You can't simply plug holes with DNA from a different zoological class. Despite Gould's empirical chastisement, what's particularly interesting about his essay on the cultural phenomenon of Jurassic Park is the way it shows a paleontologist grappling with the emergence of a new form of digital imagery, as seen in Steven Spielberg's film adaptation of 1993. For Gould, the importance of the Jurassic Park phenomenon lay not so much in whether the techniques proposed by Crichton's story were practicable, but that the convincingly realistic computer-generated organism created new opportunities for the visual articulation and study of an extinct species. It was a kind of immersive cinematic data visualization of reptilian life whose fidelity was unprecedented. I just thought I'd include this to sort of illustrate something of what happened to Jurassic Park when it itself became subject to an evolution through the kind of meme sphere. So Joey's work makes kind of frequent recourse to the reptile, the figure of the reptile. This is a photograph from one of her Tumblr sites, Dark Creatures. In one instance, she alludes directly to the conflation of religion and the reptilian. Recent exhibitions with Victor Timothy and John Russell have utilised ancient cryptography to suggest that somewhere in our genetic history we may find evidence of the guiding hand of alien intervention. This is the exhibition Lament of Cast in Plymouth. But the same kind of mysterious cryptographic symbols seem to have found their way onto the MRI scanner, which is currently on show at Weising. Which I read as kind of clues to a conspiracy stretching beyond the bounds of historical comprehension and into a deep time of miasmatic conjecture and the appearance on Earth of technologically advanced ancient astronauts capable of engineering Homo sapiens as a servile race. This all sounds pretty silly. It's a stuff of popular ufology fads in the 1970s, and the speculation as to the reptilian nature of our extraterrestrial masters underscores more political paranoia in the United States than you'd like to think. So the idea comes from the eccentric late 20th century author Zechariah Sitchin, whose cavalier interpretation of Sumerian tablets, which according to him only he could interpret correctly, misreads symbolic tropes and the limits of two-dimensional representation as literal depictions of an alien race called the Anunnaki, who bred with Homo erectus to create a race of servile subjects who would mine the gold they needed to sustain life on their own planet, Nibiru. According to Sitchin, Nibiru is this kind of evasive celestial body that every 3,600 years makes an orbit of the Earth and kind of passes between Mars and Jupiter. The idea, I think, is one of kind of conservation, so they don't have gold present on their own planet, but gold is something that they can use as like an atmospheric particulate to protect themselves from solar radiation. So the idea is that the human race has been enslaved, turned into a mining colony, and used to excavate gold, which then becomes a kind of protective filter for their home world. Filtered through the paranoid writings of ex-TV presenter David Icke, and injected with a little light fancy from Robert E. Howard, the author of popular adventure novels and the creator of the reptilian mythos, Sitchin's original proposition has mutated into the widespread belief that the New World Order, the Bilderberg Group, the British Royal Family, and any other power-wielding collective you can name are actually representatives of the reptilian agenda on Earth. These are some visualizations of Anunnaki visitation. What What's interesting is how the speculation has turned into a forensic analysis enabled by the poor image. Low-resolution photographs and video files that result in peculiar distortions of physiognomy as a result of data compression. So the idea that when images are compressed and they lose some kind of visual information, you get these kind of data moshing variations in terms of the fidelity of a face's representation. So these digital artifacts seem to exacerbate a paranoia complex that reads compressed digital code literally as genetic code, subjecting distorted footage of politicians to a notational analysis. Drawing on the writings of philosopher Evan Calder-Williams, I'm tempted to characterise these absurd digitally mediated subjects as the dream image of an absent clarity. If only it were that easy to point through the diaphanous haze of global financial crisis and ecological collapse to identify such a clearly defined cause. These are low-resolution images matched by a low-resolution political clarity. Okay, I'm going to finish on that one.
Joey and I talked about that we really wanted this speculative afterthoughts to be the whole thing. So it worked.
It's real.
It's real. It's real speculative. So thank you all of the contributors, Joey, Kitsune, Marco, Ketcher and Jamie, and to all of you for coming in today and joining as well. I hope you enjoyed today. It's definitely thought-provoking and kind of leave us with much more to think about.